Hi, and welcome to another episode of What It Takes. You know, I've always lived in the Northeast, but I've been thinking a lot about the West lately. We just took our kids on a road trip through Arizona and New Mexico to let them experience a very different America from the one where we live near Washington, D.C. And wow, it is different from the ground up. The writer Wallace Stegner once said that to see the beauty of the West, quote, you have to get over the color green. You have to quit associating beauty with gardens and lawns. You have to get used to an inhuman scale. You have to understand geological time. And so it was still with the dust of sandstone on my hiking boots that I mined the Academy of Achievements archive, looking for the wisdom of Wallace Stegner and another of the greatest writers ever to come out of the American West, N. Scott Mamadé. Mamadé is a Kiowa Indian, a poet and a novelist who was exposed early on in life to the storytelling traditions of several tribes. Here he is reading an excerpt from one of his poems, Crow Dance at Zia.
Even before sunrise, there is color everywhere and the good smell of smoke and coffee. Where crows' feet stamp the earth, a friction rises, an old ceremonial heat, and there is in the ancient order a balance of all things in the universe and the formidable carriage of crows.
When Scott Mamadé was a creative writing fellow at Stanford in the 1960s, he studied under the other featured writer of this episode, Wallace Stegner. Stegner had generations of notable students and disciples, including Larry McMurtry, Ken Kesey, Wendell Berry, Scott Turow, Ernest Gaines, even Sandra Day O'Connor. He grew up in many places, but he embraced the American West so forcefully that he's considered its preeminent literary voice. Stegner, a novelist, essayist, and short story writer, won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, Angle of Repose, and also the National Book Award for The Spectator Bird. Here's an excerpt from the audio version of that book, read by Edward Herman.
On a February morning, when a weather front is moving in off the Pacific but has not quite arrived, and the winds are changeable and gusty and clouds drive over, and an occasional flurry of fine rain darkens the terrace bricks, this place conforms to none of the clichés about California with which they advertise the sunshine cities for the sunset years. No bland sky, no cool morning overcast, no placid afternoons fading into chilly evenings. This is North Sea weather. The sky boils with cloud. The sun glares out now and then like the opening eye of a doped patient. And the brief beam of intelligence it shoots forth lights on the hills and turns a distant subdivision into a view of Toledo.
Wallace Stegner and N. Scott Mamadé, both Pulitzer Prize winners, in their own voices on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Academy? This child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Once or twice a year, we bring you an episode that gives you a feel for one of the amazing things that happens at an Academy of Achievement Summit. People at the very peak of their fields, whether prime ministers, basketball coaches, financiers, country singers, Nobel Prize-winning scientists, or writers, stand before young delegates from around the world and inspire them by talking about what it takes to succeed and to make a difference in this world. This is one of those episodes. You'll hear N. Scott Mamaday talking about what the sacred means to him, and Wallace Stegner talking about the meaning of belonging to a place. We'll start with Stegner, who gave his address at the 1991 Academy of Achievement Summit in New York.
There's been much said and said well about how to challenge the world and make it say uncle, how to make a success and achieve things in the world. I'd like to take it from another side for a moment. The interior landscape rather than the challenge to the world. Once I heard somebody at a meeting like this ask John Cheever why he wrote, and he said to try to make sense of my life, which is a very good answer. The unexamined life, as the wise Greek said, is not worth living. Especially for people of certified intelligence and gifts, which you all are. Henry James once talked to a bunch of young writers in New England and advised them to be people upon whom nothing is lost. That's pretty good advice for anybody. I would add to it, also, try to avoid being one of those who have no connections with anything, which the modern world, I think, tends to create. We don't stay within even a single sex very often. Don't stay with the same wife, don't live in the same place, don't work for the same company, don't live in the same house. I think a certain continuity is necessary, and I'll tell you why. You are members of a community, most of you. You're members of a region, of a country, of a culture, of an ecology, a species. And if you find it, as I sometimes do, a weed species, that isn't any reason to belong to it less or love it the less. It's only an excuse to try to mitigate its weediness. Literary careers can't be planned for, like many careers. I've taught enough young writers to know how often things can go astray and how hard it is to predict, because nobody knows his own talent and other people can't predict for him. The only way you find out if you have talent is whether you find readers. If you don't find readers, you probably don't have the talent. So you can't plan for a literary career. Your talent will manifest itself in some fashion or other. It will make itself felt, and it will have to get said in whatever medium you choose to say it in. All you can do with it is discipline and train and direct it. And let me tell you a little bit about how accidental that can be. I grew up on the tail end of almost the last frontier on the continent, not quite, but almost. The conditions we lived in Saskatchewan were very, very comparable to the conditions of Kansas in the 1860s, the same kind of short grass frontier. I didn't, in my childhood town, have any art, any music, apart from some folk music, any literature. There were no books in town. There was no library. No architecture except a grain elevator. I hadn't ever witnessed the effect of a lawn. I had never seen a lawn. I had never seen a water closet until I was 11 years old and we moved to Great Falls, Montana. And I had never seen a city, really, of any kind until we moved to Salt Lake a year or so later. That's deprivation of a kind. It's also in many ways an advantage because you do build up a head of steam coming from nowhere. You have lots of places to go. You have no notion that you can be a writer, though you know you like words and you like books. Your teachers tell you your themes are okay. People encourage you. You say something and somebody raises his ears and you try to do it again. But it never occurred to me that you could be a writer. I never saw a writer until I was past 21, I don't suppose. One in the flesh, those were things that happened far off and long ago. I got to be a writer simply by accident, by pure inadvertence, by being pushed someplace by teachers. Nobody in my family had ever gone past the eighth grade in school. So I wind up with a PhD, and I practice writing, and I go east to teach. Well, first I teach at Utah, then at Wisconsin, then at Harvard. And finally, when I go back, I am aware of my abysmal lacks, because I had belonged to nothing. I had no history, no tradition, no anything. I began to read history in order to find out where I belong, because it had about occurred to me by then that I was one of those people that Wendell Berry, one of my former students, speaks of when he says, if you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are. I began to investigate the West that I had grown up in, read its history, look at its conditions. And those conditions and that history told me that that part of the world had not been settled properly. It had been raided. It had not been married. It had been raped. I got interested in trying to see what could be done about recording some of its history, even writing some of its history, and in saving some of the country that I had grown up in and loved, which was being devastated at a considerable pace. So I find myself eventually, to find out who I was, trying to locate myself in space and time, and becoming almost a professional Westerner, I suppose, because that was what I knew, and that was what I also needed to know. I had to find out who I was and where I was before I could be anything, before I could really write any books. Once you got to that point, and you may not have to go through all that preliminary, I hope you don't, you can let your talent manifest itself as it will, because it will. It can't be kept down. I often told students that if they could be discouraged, they should be. And if you can't be discouraged, then you're going to make it, probably, because that will be a sign that you're on your way. After that, the whole job is to see it truthfully, to see it as accurately as you possibly can, and to put it down and to keep on loving it, warts and all. That's the way I love this country, I guess, warts and all. And I work on the warts. That's, I think, all I have to say. Thank you.
That's Wallace Stegner speaking at the Academy of Achievement Summit in 1991. He died in 1993, and I should mention, some of his nonfiction writings about the land and about history helped fuel the modern environmental movement. Now, on to N. Scott Mamaday. He spent his first year of life on the Kiowa Indian Reservation in Oklahoma, but his parents moved the family to work as teachers on Indian reservations in Arizona. So Mamaday grew up among Navajo, Apache, and Pueblo. He was always interested in poetry, but he came to national prominence when his first novel, House Made of Dawn, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. The book and the prize were game changers for Native American writers. Mamaday's written a dozen books since, and he's been a professor of creative writing and of the American Indian oral tradition at several universities, including Berkeley and Stanford, where he studied long before with Wallace Stegner. Here he is speaking in Montana's Glacier National Park at the 1993 Academy of Achievement Summit.
In the Kiowa tribe, of which I am a member, we talk about time past in this way. It happened a long time ago when dogs could talk. So I want to tell you, first of all, you know, when I woke up this morning, I hadn't the vaguest idea what I wanted to say to you. But now, having spent a little time looking at the sunlight on the rolling Montana landscape, I know exactly what I want to say. The first thing is this. I'd like to tell you who I am. I'm Scott Mamaday. But I'm also Tsoai Tali. That is my Indian name. And I tell you how I came to be given that name. It means rock tree boy. And I'm named for Devil's Tower, Wyoming, which the Kayo is called Tsoai, rock tree. And they have a story about it. They say that, yes, during the course of our migration from the headwaters of the Yellowstone to the southern plains, we lived for a time in the Black Hills. And when we were there, some children, some Kiowa children, were playing in the woods. Eight children, seven sisters and their brother. The boy was pretending to be a bear, and he was chasing his sisters through the woods. The girls were pretending to be afraid. They were running. Well, in the course of this game, a terrible thing happened. The boy actually turned into a bear. And when the girls saw this, they were truly terrified, and they ran for their lives and the bear after them. And as they were running, they passed the stump of a tree. And the tree spoke to them and said, "If you will climb upon me, I will save you." And the girls scampered on top of the tree stump, and as they did so, it began to rise into the air. The bear came to kill them, but they were beyond its reach. It reared up and scored the bark all around with its claws. The story ends simply. The seven sisters were born into the sky, and they became the stars of the Big Dipper. Well, when I was just an infant, my parents, and at the time we were living at the ancestral homestead on Rainy Mountain Creek in Oklahoma, my parents took me to Devil's Tower. And we were there several days, a week perhaps. I don't have any actual remembrance of it. I was too little, though I have been there several times since. And we came back to Oklahoma. It was in August, and an old man of the tribe, an old man whose name was Pol Haw, Prairie Wolf, came to visit. And he took me up in his arms, and he began to talk. And he told stories. He told of all the good things and all the bad things that had happened to the Kiowas in the course of time. And after a long time of storytelling, he looked down at me and he said, "And now you are Tsoai Tali, rock tree boy." And so I was given this name to commemorate my having been taken to this very sacred place in Kiowa tradition. And that's a word that I would say again and again to you, sacred. It's something that means a great deal to me, and I think it ought to mean a great deal to you. I have, of course, always identified with the boy who turned into a bear, and I am a bear. And if I should turn into a bear on this occasion, I must ask your, you know, your, bear with me. I'm sorry. I do stoop to that level on occasion. The Kiowa people are a plains people. And I want to tell you that four principles informed the plains culture, the great warrior society of that culture. And the four principles were these: first, bravery; second, fortitude; third, generosity; and fourth, virtue, or right behavior, appropriate behavior, if you will. My father used to tell me about the old man dragonfly, Koi Kanhodl in Kiowa. When my father was a boy of 8 or 10 years, Koi Kanhodl, dragonfly, used to come to the house to pay a visit. He would come on horseback, and he, in the proper notion of a Kiowa visit, he would stay for days. And every morning, my father tells me, dragonfly would get up, paint his wrinkled face, go out to the east side of the house, I know precisely where he stood, and he would raise his arms and he would pray aloud to the rising sun. I love to think of that man. My father would watch from hiding, full of fear and holy awe, and I have seen that man so many times in my mind's eye. And his faith is my faith. I love to think of his investment in the earth and in the sky and in the sun. It means a great deal to me, and I have predicated much of my life on that particular kind of reverence. Every day, and appropriately, Dragonfly would reinvent the sacred. I believe, when I'm speaking to you young people particularly, I believe that life should be lived fully and to the last moment. And it should be relished. And Charles Kuralt, who is here and who is a brilliant storyteller, in his book, Life on the Road, A Life on the Road, tells of an old man, a retired professor, who had loved his work as a professor. And when he had to retire, he took a job as janitor at the university so that he could remain with his beloved students. I think there is a great reinvention of the sacred in such an example. Life must be lived fully, and it must be informed with purpose. Our destiny, I think, is to struggle for the salvation of our soul, to fix our sight upon something that is worthy of us, and then to strive for it as we are able. Death must be earned. We must not shy from it. We must accept it as the ultimate limit of our lives, and we must appreciate it for what it is. I was reading a play by August Wilson the other day called Fences, and one of the characters talks about death in the play, and he says, "Ah, death, don't talk to me about that. I know about that. Death and I have wrestled together. Death is nothing but a fastball over the outside corner." And it seems to me that there might be worse ways to look at life and death. We must try to understand what has happened, not only in our personal lives, but in our racial lives, the history of our civilization. We must try to understand that. I had a wonderful teacher at Stanford who said this: unless we understand the history that produced us, we are determined by that history. We may be determined in any event, but the understanding gives us a chance. I want to tell you, young people, to define yourselves. Do not allow yourselves to be defined by others. Twyla Tharp, a couple of days ago, said something that really registered in my heart. She said something like this: don't let anyone steal you from yourself. I can't think of better advice. Imagine yourselves, imagine who you are, and then have the courage and the determination to live up to your imagination. I have been imagined by others. I have been defined by others all my life. It happens to us, doesn't it? When I was a little boy, people would formulate an idea of who I was, and then I felt the stress of having to live up to their definition, and that's a mistake. That's too bad. It's too bad that we have to go through that. But we can come to a point where we refuse to allow that to happen, and that's what I would advise you to do. People even now come up to me and they say, "Oh, you're Scott Momaday." "Yeah, I know about you. You were a writer, aren't you? You're a Native American writer." You know, they put that label on me right away. And yeah, you teach, right? You teach. University professor. You've written several books, and I know about your subject. You're a poet. I've read some of your poems. You're a cook. You like to hike. You ride an Appaloosa mare named Ma'am. Yeah, that's who you are. And I say, "Yeah, you know, that's my first inclination. Oh, yeah, you're right. That's me." But then, given a moment of sanity, I say, no, I am so Itali, and I'm a bear. In The Way to Rainy Mountain, there is a story about a man who is saved by a dog. The man has been abandoned. He's alone on the plain. He has expended all of his arrows hunting game. He has no arrows left. He is at the mercy of the elements and the enemies around him. Along comes a dog. And the dog says to the man, this is a long time ago when dogs could talk. By the way, they stopped talking on a Thursday. The dog said, you're in trouble. There are enemies all around. You're completely surrounded. I would not like to be in your moccasins. And the man said, tell me something I don't know. You know, of course I'm in trouble, and I understand that. And the dog says, well, I could save you. And the man said, well, please, if you can help me, please do so. I'm desperate. And the dog said, now, wait a minute. You know how dogs are. I have puppies. They are little. They are cold. They are hungry. If you will promise to take care of my puppies, I will save you. So, of course, the bargain was struck. The man agreed to take care of the puppies, and the story ends, the dog led the man round and round, and they came to safety. Well, several years ago, I was invited to speak to a group of sixth graders at the Hebrew Academy of San Francisco, and I was wondering what to tell them. I thought of that story, and so I began, and I came to that part which has it that this happened a long time ago when dogs could talk. And a little girl in the front row looked up at me and she said, those were the days. I want to greet you warmly, to congratulate you heartily, and with all my heart, to wish you well.
That's poet and National Medal of the Arts recipient N. Scott Mamaday, speaking in 1993. And what you're hearing is a Kiowa song. Before we close out today's episode, I have to play you just one more piece of audio. It's amazing what you can find in the Academy of Achievement Archive. This is an original piece Mamaday wrote for an Academy event at Wrigley Field in Chicago in 2004. It's called God and the Bear Talk About Baseball. Mamaday was joined on stage by renowned actor, the voice, James Earl Jones, to read the new work, a tribute to the enduring faith of Cubs fans, who were at that point 96 years into their World Series championship slump. Mamaday played God, and James Earl Jones, the bear.
My Cubs have learned a few things about baseball, and so have I. For example, we have learned that baseball engenders a loyalty that is ineffable, and it is conjoined with suffering. I'm not talking about physical suffering only, the sprained ankles, the broken fingers and ribs, the aborted slides and collisions at home plate. I'm talking about the festering wounds in the soul, the loyalty that is nourished by loss, a cancer that invades hope. I have learned that a great and indispensable part of baseball consists in suffering. To hell with the agony of defeat. There's a truer agony in victory. Victory exacts a greater price. Many more games are lost than won. Many more players are consigned to oblivion than to fame. We must fear victory, for it is a country that we do not know. It is a terrain full of pits and stones. It is a luxury we cannot afford. This I have learned.
You astonish me, Urset. You astonish God.
The fans.
The fans.
Their suffering is acute, endemic, exquisite, for their loyalty is divine. Like Merlin, they are imprisoned in rings of air, and the air is laden with a sense of peanuts, cracker jacks, hot dogs, and beer. Oh, they are a blessed lot. Their pain is delicious. Their cause is bright and futile. Their destiny lies in the blur of the white sphere.
Thanks for listening to What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler. What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. See you next time when we'll feature Demis Hassabis, former chess prodigy, game developer, neuroscientist, and one of the young pioneers of artificial intelligence. By the way, you can learn about hundreds of towering, inspiring figures from all walks of life at achievement.org.